I think we're ready to go now. A few introductions before I introduce the speaker. My name is Stephen McLeod. I worked for NHS Group for Glasgow McLeod, and I've been asked to chair the fourth Glasgow Centre for Population Health Seminar. I've been to a number of these seminars, and for me, these are a way of escaping from the humdrum sometimes of day-to-day work and actually thinking about bigger things. And I was really pleased to see this advertised because David Kustak, who you will hear from in a second, has a history of working youth work, and I started youth work, and I liked some of his examples when they came to hear some of his experiences. But just before I introduce David, let's do some housekeeping. We're going to start just now. David will speak for about 45 minutes, and then we'll have some Q&A. And when we have the Q&A, I'll ask colleagues to identify themselves and say where they're from, because I don't recognise anybody in the room. It's a bit for me. There may be a few people arriving late, and you can find some seats at the back, but let's try not to let that disturb us. If you could put your mobile phones off just now, and I'll try to be able to do that too. And at the end of the seminar, at 5:45 will be canapes will be served, and we might extend things if we're doing really well and we've got some more questions. And please feel free to hang back and have a discussion amongst yourselves, perhaps get some time with David. So, David, the title, I think, attracted me to this, The Code of the Street, How We Interpret Morality. And when I look behind that, I love the idea of David's experience working with young people, and then the contacts that they would make with him, perhaps when a few years later, when they reflected on the experience that he had with him, and some of the conversations that we've had with him. That's happened to me. And it happened to me a couple of days ago where a young woman met me in the street, and she's 22, and she reminded me that I bought her a pencil set for her 9th birthday, and she still had that pencil set and how much it meant to her. And, you know, I'd forgotten about the pencil set, but I think the point was that little small things, that the relationship between adults and children at key points in their life can leave a big, an indelible imprint that adults don't really realise, and I think through the course of time the imprint can become very significant. David works for Kids Company, and he's going to talk about his experiences working with Kids Company and his experiences of going to Oxford and doing a degree later on, and how he's managed to combine his personal experiences earlier on with his academic experiences and turn that back into on his youth work. Thank you, David.
Sorry, I'm just going to turn the mute on. Can you hear me properly?
Yes.
All right. I'm just going to leave the papers here and then I'll turn to them in a minute. Much of what I'm going to say today is just anecdotal. It can't be verified. It's my opinion. It's my perspective. So what I'm going to ask you guys to do is to use your imagination and to step outside and kind of like use your imagination to think about what may be and what possibilities there are out there in terms of interpreting what's going on for our young people. One of my hypotheses is that I read a book while I was at Oxford called Benedict Anderson. I don't know if anyone knows it. Imagined Communities, and in it he argues that communities are imagined and nationalism was constructed. And I kind of looked at a lot of the stuff that I did in my own life and looked at some of the work I did with young people. And one of the words that a lot of young people use is they call themselves soldiers. They call themselves regiments, battalions. They always have these allude to kind of military connotations. And I thought, what's this about? And then I realised that a lot of the time, their street corners, their neighbourhoods were kind of like micro-nationalisms, like nationalisms of neighbourhood. And I wanted to explore, you know, why they felt such an affinity to a gang structure, or why I felt such an affinity to the area that I lived in. So one of the things I'm going to do is to go back and imagine 43 years ago in Peckham, in southeast London. I grew up with 5 other siblings in one room, an Irish mother and a West Indian father, 1967, so it's pre a lot of the Equality Acts. We lived in what you would call a hovel. I know I'm in Glasgow and there's called the Gorbals and that, but we did live in a hovel. There were rats, there were mice, it sounds like a sob story. Every time I say this to people, I think, is this really me? We lived in one room for 5 years. That was pre-Race Relations Act. So I was a mixed race boy living in a predominantly white area, going to school in a predominantly black area. So I had to kind of, translate what it meant to me to travel between these two different worlds. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was a compulsive eater. I don't mind saying stuff like that. I suffered what you'd call abuse, physical and emotional abuse, racism, all those kind of things. And about the age of seven, I retreated into myself and sort of what I'd call my imagination or my safe space, and actually created a world inside myself that I used to live in books. And if anyone remembers The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, that was my favourite book. And maybe this is Narnia, I don't know. I made Fragment anyway, but and that's where I found myself. I found myself in literature, I found myself in the word, I found myself being able to define my world for me. But as a lot of the other people I work with, I never let anyone know that I was smart. I never let anyone know that I had that type of intelligence. I just kind of retreated into myself. So for the next 15 years, I had a dualistic experience. So at home, I would go home and I would take the abuse from my family, and then I would go out onto the street and exercise power and control and terror. Right, sorry, I hate using that word, but I was what you call sociopathic. So intelligent with violence, meant for violence, means a lot of the time that you can get what you want. So for a long time, I felt I was getting what I wanted. I left home at 15, I moved on to a local council estate with a close friend of mine, where we got involved in various nefarious activities. Met someone when I was 19, got married at 19, and settled down, moved into a home. Wasn't a very nice person to live with, as you can imagine, with those feelings of omnipotence and power and control that I wanted over my then partner. At 29, a series of revelations came into my life, left my wife, found that I had epilepsy, all these kind of things, and then decided that I wanted to go back and study. I was working in a job centre at the time. I knew I was smart, I was doing lots of advocacy for us, other members of staff and stuff, and luckily my trade union had a scheme where they paid for you to take time off work and go and do GCSEs in O-levels, so that's what I did. So I did those secretly as well, no one knew I was doing that. So all the way along there was this kind of, you know, inner world and outer world, which is really important in what I'm going to say later, because, you know, they can be both as important as each other, but sometimes they never speak. So I did that. Conveniently, one of the external advisors on my course was an Oxford Don, which doesn't normally happen, and read some of my work, which was writing around working class identity. She said I was quite smart. I thought, fine, if you think I'm smart, I'll come and have a look. So she invited me up to Oxford. I looked around the college that I ended up going to at Wadham and thought, this is quite interesting. Maybe I'll do a bit of this for 3 years. And that was all it was. It was short-termism. So as I'm standing here and I'm unraveling in front of you, it's actually kind of seemed quite weird to me. So I ended up going to Wadham in Oxford for 3 years. I studied history, and my specialism was the Renaissance, which I don't know how I ended up looking at the Renaissance, but maybe, I don't know what relevance they had to me, but you know, maybe I was an enlightened man at the time, I don't know. Did that, after that, thinking what could I do? I'll explain in my piece later, but you know, the experiences that I had at Oxford were quite confusing. I was the only person of my ethnicity in the whole history school, which is about 1,000 students. There were 9 West Indian men as undergraduates in the whole of Oxford at the time. Of them, I think there were only 4 of us that were from state schools or had a state school background. So we're kind of dealing with not just hegemonic structures, but actual real physical barriers. And while I was there, I might as well reveal this, I got stopped on many occasions going into tutorials in Christchurch or into Trinity College as well. I got stopped just to get addressed all the time. And that was at the same time as I was coming back to London and knowing what I was doing in Oxford and still getting stopped and searched on the street and asking where I was going. So there was an overlap. I'm not asking for sympathy, I'm just saying it's the kind of worlds that people have to negotiate. After that, I did a year working in a school in South Camden Community School as a learning mentor. I don't know what it was, but all along, I just kind of wanted to find out, seems really cliche, but who I was and what I was and where I was going and all this kind of existential stuff. But conveniently, you know, I thought it's got to be about young people. It has to be about young people, because I knew that the resilience that I had, I knew that the luck that I had had was luck. It was contingent upon the kindness of strangers and randomness. And I thought, so I think to myself, I can't be the only clever person that I know from my background. I can't be the only person who has that spark. It can't just be me. I never really shared that with anyone, but I just realised it couldn't just be me, because I grew up with guys, and that's where I learned my intelligence from. That's where I learned my code of the street. That's where I learned my, as I'll talk later, Isaiah Berlin and those guys called Metis, that perpetual innovation, the thing that we're going to need at the moment as the world's changing. Those kind of skills, those kind of the ability to flip between structuralist and culturalist ideas, if you want to say, in terms of paradigms. So after I did a year teaching in a school and learning mentoring, and then I thought, what can I do? And I thought, Oxford, yeah, more about some more status. So I thought, I know what I do, history, I'll do the bar. So as you do, you think I'll become a barrister. And what you do when you go to Oxford and you have the benefit of good education, you say, well, I'll go and get a scholarship, which is the structure. So I went to the Middle Temple, won a scholarship, sat down in front of all these guys, became an Asprey scholar, a Harmsall scholar, went to law school, still didn't feel I fitted in, still kind of rebelled, even though I didn't want to be good at stuff, I was quite good at stuff. Went through pupillage interviews hoping that I would fail. No, they liked me. So everywhere I wanted to go, I just didn't want to fit in, but I kept on thinking, well, what's going on here? So won up some scholarships there, then took a year out again to go and work in Peckham, the area that I actually grew up in, and I worked in a place called the Peckham Youth Training Initiative, which was set up actually on the street I was born on, which was very strange. So I ended up working there for a year, trying to work with the local gangs and the local young guys around there, trying to get them to see the world the way I thought I saw it, and they just told me to piss off, and who are you sell out, and all these kind of things. And that really hurt me, I have to admit. One of the things I have to say is that, when we're talking about tough love works on us as much as anything else, because the rejection really, really, really scarred me, and actually drove me on to try and look at what I was doing. So, because I went there thinking, they're going to understand me, we're safe, we're brothers, we're this, but we're soldiers, and they were like, piss off, man, you're educating, go away, what do you know, man? And I had to really, really think about that. I really had to look into myself. And then as I was looking into myself, I met my boss, Camilla. I don't know if any of you guys know Camilla, but she's a very inspiring person and a very persuasive person. And if any of you know her, this is a really bad impression of her, but it's quite accurate, I think so. So I met her, and briefly she said to me, darling David, you're status-driven. And I thought, you're right. And what I've realised is that, one of the things about material deprivation is material deprivation. You kind of look for the answer in the material world. But if you're actually quite intelligent as well, you look for the answer in the kind of cultural capital. And what I try to do is I try to trade in, instead of getting a Beamer or going to get a big house, I traded in for an Oxford degree and a career in a bar, hoping that will give me some gravitas in some way, buying my way and giving myself some leverage to move through society. And I have to agree, she said, come and work here. It'll be challenging, it'll be tough, but you'll learn something about yourself. And I thought, do I really, really want to learn something about myself? So 4 years ago, I started in what we call the Urban Academy, which is down in South London. So what I'll do is I'll go back and does anyone know what Kids Company does or how we are? I'll give you an overview of what we do. Basically, the mantra of our organisation is love is all it takes. We believe that most of the deficiencies that people say that are in our young people are because they've not been given any love and care. And then once they're given love, care and kindness, over time they'll learn the resilience, they'll learn all the things that we know. I mean, I mentioned in my paper, but we know Wilkinson and all these guys, Leah, they're all saying that happiness and kindness are all kind of natural parts. That's read Evan Phillips' book. But I never believed that. I have to be honest, I was a sceptic about love. Because one of the things about surviving, one of the things about, you do become omnipotent, you do believe, and this is one of the things you've got to deal with when you deal with young people, you do believe, because the testimony of you actually existing, it's proof that you're strong and that you can do what you like, so you don't need anyone else. And I it took me a long time to actually admit what I'm saying to you now, that, I have to admit I was a bit sceptical to Camilla for about 3 years. I've worked there for 4 years, so she's listening to this. I'm sorry, Camilla, but I have to be honest, I was sceptical as well. And what we try to do in that is, we use a holistic approach. So we use Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So I was a key worker. And so the first part of Maslow obviously is to consolidate them in the physical world, and they give them housing. So we feed them, we educate them in the housing system, in the educational system, in the legal system. And then we give them unconditional intimacy and unconditional love. And in, around that, we'll bring in massage, you know, so we can reintroduce touch, art, creativity, so that we can start getting them to start using the left side of their brains, and also physical exercise. And at the time, I was thinking, wait a minute, this is like being back at Oxford, exactly the same. You know, it was like a college, it was like an Oxford college, where I got fed every day. I got, you know, I got intimacy from my cohort. I got someone who had pastoral care for me. And I thought, this is quite strange. You know, what's going on? It's kind of like a family, a familial unit, a cohort. Going back to the original idea that I posited earlier about soldiers in an army, and, you know, what we're looking for, membership and all those kind of things. And so I've been there for 4 years, and it's been a hard journey, mate. For 2.5 years, they thought I was a paedophile. They thought I was. They thought I was fake. They thought I was a sellout. And I could never tell them. I wanted to tell them. I could never tell them that, look, man, you can never hate me as much as I hate myself. You can never, you know, want to be away from me as much as I wanted to be away from myself. I could never tell them that, because as Camilla kept on saying to us, it's not about you, it's about them, about serving them. And so for the first time in my life, I realised the transformative power of a relationship as well was within me. Because for the first time in my life, it was about actually learning to be selfless and not just living in my mind, and actually analysing and actually trying to quantify everything that I was doing, and going through a meeting of a calculator and saying, what's in this for me? What's the cost? What's the benefit? And, you know, I'm going to use some anecdotal evidence before I get on with this, but, you know, it's funny, like, I've run marathons with some of these guys now. We've done marathons, we've done crazy things together. You know, we ran Madrid together. You know, some I've trained in the gym with these guys. And one of the strangest things that's come out of all of this is the fact that they were looking for me to be stronger than I actually was. They didn't want me to be passive. They didn't want me to be patronising. They didn't want me to help them hold on to their pain. They wanted me to be a boundary. They wanted me to be present. I was talking to you earlier about that. About they wanted me to be present. They wanted me to witness them, and so they could witness me. So the thing I'm really talking about is kind of like the metaphysical relationship, the meta narrative that goes on between us at the kids' company, because it's really hard to explain. But in those intimate moments where they can reject you and you can just sit there and you just sit there calmly, that's where they learn about resilience, that's where they learn about not being rejected. And so the struggle in what we do, in the work that we do, is about where we're in it. And so one of the things that I have to do every week, which is quite unique in an organisation, I have to have a supervision once a week with a psychotherapist or an art therapist, where I start downloading who I am and why I am, so that when I go back into the relationship, because it's based on attachment theory, that's a fresh relationship, actually each moment. And that's quite unique in what we do. It's about bringing us to be present as we are there and then. Because one of the problems with a lot of organisations, I'm not saying it in here, is that we kind of pay superficial kind of attention to what's going on inside ourselves. And Camilla makes sure that we all are aware of what we bring and who we are and what we're doing. So, I mean, I just want to give you a bit of an introduction. Now, this is the first time in my life, right, I'm sharing this with you, I've ever read anything out like this. I've ever tried to attempt to write anything. So, these are the musings of an ex-madman, as somebody, the young people would say. So, please bear with me. If it's not up to scratch, then I don't mind, but it's the first step. So, I'm going to try. All right, thank you. The quote that I used at the start is, just information is not education. It is culturing behaviour, culturing attitude, and the ability to perceive things better. These require the regular use of perception, observation, and expression. This is the true story of many childhoods, including mine. Originally, I did not intend to present this in any public forum. Instead, my intention was to rid myself of the little boy I had once been. For many years, I tried to leave him behind and bury him in the deep, dark recesses of my mind. I tried to pretend he had never existed and went on to become someone he wouldn't recognise. But he was always there in the background, haunting me and waiting for his chance to burst back into life and give voice to the pain he endured. I struggled to escape him, and finally the effort of expressing him became too much. As I started to write this, he exploded back into life and screamed these words. I am his victim, born innocent, a total product of my surroundings. I could have a philosophical debate on the merits of free will, or are our lives predetermined either theologically or scientifically? I have read intensely the utilitarian arguments of Bentham and Miller, and more recently Rawls. I have read the recent scientific approaches to measurements of happiness, and Wilkinson's spirit level, or Layard's happiness, and that as a species we require love, nurture, kindness and intimacy. They all made sense to the searching and inquisitive boy inside of me, who just wanted to belong. It was in that moment that I realised the importance of belonging, the need for connection, the desire to sense feelings that lay outside of oneself. I concluded the thing that had kept me safe had been my imagination. The same imagination that inspired huge levels of abuse and neglect inspires 97% of the young people that we work with, the kids coming in, to improve their own lives. It is in the imagination that one will find the thesis for which I wish to state that there is a code of the street, and that in context, the reactions and attitude of many young people cannot be simply ascribed to a lack of morality. Benedict Anderson in his Imagined Communities states that nationness as well as nationalism are cultural artifacts of a particular kind. To understand them properly, we need to consider how they have come into historical being, in what ways their meanings have changed over time, and why they command such profound emotional legitimacy. He argues that once created, they become modular, capable of being transported to a great variety of social terrains. He argues that the nation is an imagined political community. He also argues that communities are to be distinguished not by their falsity or genuineness, this is really important to me, but by the style in which they are imagined. It is also imagined as a community because regardless of the actual inequality and exploitation that might prevail, the nation, or in my instance, the neighbourhood or the gang, is always conceived as a deep horizontal comradeship. It is doubtful whether either social change or transformed consciousness... Sorry, I'm going to drink. This is the first time I've ever spoken this long. I feel quite professional. Thanks. Always wanted to do this every drink. Wait a minute, thanks. Can I ask a research question? Is this okay? It is doubtful whether either social change or transformed consciousness in them does much to explain the attachment that people feel for the inventions of their imaginations, why people are ready to die for their inventions. It is useful to remind ourselves that nations inspire love and often profoundly self-sacrificing love. The cultural products of nationalism, poetry, prose and music show this love clearly in thousands of different forms and styles. And I wanted to make an interjection there because one of the things that when everyone talks about young people and they talk about what influences them, they talk about music, they talk about the language they're using, they talk about those kind of things, and I'm trying to say there's a kind of a similarity there. We can talk about this after that. Sort of nice introduction there. The great wars of this century are extraordinary in the colossal numbers persuaded to lay down their lives. Nothing connects us effectively to the dead more than language. There's a special kind of contemporaneous community which language alone suggests. Tellingly, Anderson states that the state dialectically engendered the grammar of the nationalisms that arose to combat it. One might go far as to say that the state imagined its local adversaries as in an ominous prophetic dream well before they came into historical existence. So it's like they're kind of thinking about games that sort of being constructed that way. Neuroscience is clearly demonstrating that there are structural and functional variations in individuals who have been deprived of a caring attachment in childhood. At Kids Company, we're of the view that these young people require repairing so they can complete developmental tasks which trauma may have inhibited, being a service that functions as a good mother experience, giving the child the resources to manage emotional energy, and a good father experience to give the young person a positive drive towards the outside world. It was in the competing narratives that I saw played out on a daily basis in the media when describing young people and the reality that I saw on the street that I wish to emphasise this talk. Despite their importance and relevance to academic performance, risk variables and cultural pressures alone cannot explain individual behaviour. Many young people still find ways to survive, and in many cases to excel. Interestingly, we know much less about resilience, perseverance and the coping strategies employed by individuals whose lives are surrounded by hardships than we know about those who succumb and become victims of their environment. Deepening our understanding of how individuals cope with and respond to their social and cultural environments is an important part of finding ways to assist young people with living healthy and productive lives. It is through talking to the young people that we have discerned what they feel that they're lacking or required to make their lives whole. Britain has one of the worst teenage dropout rates of any developed country, with more than 1 in 10 of those aged 15 to 19 not in school, work or training. Britain also has among the highest numbers who fail to complete their higher education. Vocational courses have a particularly low graduation rate. In 2007, 10.7% of 15 to 19-year-olds were not in school, work or training, moving Britain from 6th to the worst on OECD lists. The UK may have formally signed up to the United Nations Convention for the Rights of the Child, but are these principles enshrined not only in our policies but in our culture? The grim reality of many young people's lives would dispute this. Sir Al Ainsley Green, the UK's first Children's Commissioner, has recently talked of the malaise at the heart of British society. However, do current statistics of child abuse not suggest a more fundamental antipathy towards children and young people in general? As the UN Convention states, children have rights as human beings, yet also need special care and protection. As their guardians, adults are responsible for the safe rearing of their young, and yet we consistently let them down, as the statistics reveal. Where does this deep disregard for children stem from, and how can it be addressed? Social scientists offer a number of theories to interpret entrenchment of that disregard for children. Critical medical anthropology sees the root cause of violence in society as a pathology triggered by embedded inequality, which lies at the heart of our class-driven society. Indeed, social mobility has deteriorated and the gap between rich and poor widened over the last 30 years. Structural violence could be defined as the constraints and behaviour and options imposed by institutionalised inequalities in wealth and power on those who are underprivileged. It could be argued it's built on abuses of power, which are most overt in countries with high rates of relative poverty. It is the recent book, The Spirit Level, by Walters and Pickett, that offers both an analysis of what has always been at the core of our unequal society and maybe an answer to the problems we face. The authors point out that the life diminishing results of value and growth above equality in rich societies can be seen all around us. Inequality causes shorter, unhealthier and unhappier lives. It increases the rate of teenage pregnancy, violence, obesity, imprisonment and addiction. And quote, we find ourselves anxiety ridden, prone to depression, driven to consume, and with little or no community life. That's not my life, I think. I'm hoping it's not your life, but that's what you're saying. Anyway, my life's quite happy. I'm quite happy at the moment. The author argues, as do I, that removal of economic impediments to feeding values, such as low wages, low benefits and low public spending on education, for instance, will allow a flourishing of human potential. In my view, aspiration can't just be about something beyond, something that is always being chased, something external. It has to be aspiration in the here and now, improving transport, creating jobs, helping create low-carbon communities and building youth clubs. In the social sciences, explanations of human behaviour, especially that of the poor, have been the subject of considerable debate. Most often the debate centres on those who favour structural explanations of behaviour and those who prefer cultural explanations of behaviour. Structuralists genuinely focus on political economy, the availability of jobs and economic opportunities, class structure and social geography. From this perspective, individuals are viewed as products of their environment and changes in individual behaviour are made possible by changes in the structure of opportunity. From this theoretical perspective, holding an individual responsible for their behaviour makes little sense, because their behaviour is shaped by forces beyond their control of any particular individual. Drug abuse, crime and dropping out of school are largely seen as social consequences of inequality. According to this view, the most effective way to reduce objective behaviour is to reduce the degree and extent of inequality in society. In contrast, culturists downplay the significance of environmental factors and treat human behaviour as a product of beliefs, values, norms and socialisation. Cultural explanations of behaviour focus on the moral codes that operate within particular family, communities and groups. For example, the idea that poor people are trapped within a culture of poverty, which has the effect of legitimising criminal and immoral behaviour, and that's up to you to define what immoral is, has dominated the culturalist perspective of poverty. For the culturalist, changing behaviour can only be brought about through cultural change. Hence, providing more money to inner city schools will do little to improve their academic performance, since their attitudes towards school are shaped by the culture brought from home and the neighbourhood. According to this view, culture provides the rationale and motivation for behaviour, and cultural change can be brought about through change in governmental policy about expanding opportunities. But in a comprehensive study of teen pregnancy, Kirsten Nuka demonstrates the possibility for synthesising the two perspectives. Structural and cultural explanations of human behaviour that have traditionally been seen as irreconcilable. Teen pregnancy, which for years had been much more prevalent among poor minority girls than middle class white girls, has traditionally been explained as either the product of wealth dependency and permissive sexual mores, the culturalists, or the unfortunate result of inadequate access to birth control and economic opportunities, the structuralists. Through detailed interviews with a diverse sample of teen mothers, Luca puts forward a different explanation that draws from both the cultural and structural perspectives and acknowledges the role and importance of individual choice. She points out that while both middle class and lower class girls engage in premarital sex and sometimes become pregnant, middle class girls are less likely to have babies during adolescence because they have a clear sense that it will harm their chance for future success. In contrast, when confronted with an unexpected pregnancy, poor girls are more likely to have babies because they do not perceive it as negatively affecting their future, since college and a good job are already perceived as being out of their reach. In fact, many girls in this situation actually believe that having a baby during adolescence will help them settle down, since they will now be responsible for another life, and I can verify that because that's what lots of girls say I want to respect. Given the importance of individual choice to this particular behaviour, any effort to reduce teen pregnancy that does not take into account the reasoning that guides decision making is unlikely to succeed. Similarly, efforts to improve, similarly, efforts to improve the academic performance of Afro-Caribbean males must begin by understanding the attitudes that influence how they perceive schooling and academic pursuits. To the extent that if this doesn't happen, attempts to help black males based primarily on the sensibilities of those initiating are unlikely to be effective and may be just no more successful than attempts to reduce drug use or violence by urging kids just to say no. And how long have I got left? I just wanted to know. 10 minutes.
No, you've got
20
minutes.
I've got 20 minutes. Ah. Ooh. Does anyone actually know what I'm trying to posit here? On one level, we've got to look at the way we define and the process that we use to kind of observe. But at the same time, we have to understand that the paradigm that a lot of these young people are living in and the mental space that they're living in is completely different from the ones that we're in. Even though they're ascribing the same structures, they reflect, they do all the things that we do. You know, that's all I'm trying to say. It's the musings of a madman, but I might as well get on with it. One of the things that I'm always asked at events is the situation as bad as it seems? I don't know if anyone else asked that question. And the thing that's always brought up, and I'm dragging out some stuff and trying to like make this last a bit longer, is it Hobbesian? Is the situation Hobbesian? Is it a war of all against all? Are we all, you know, living this? Are the kids I work with living this kind of nasty, brutal, short life? And is there any hope in there? And on the way down, you can see this handwritten. Right? These are the musings of me thinking about what I'd learned about Hobbes. And one of the things that I think people forget about Hobbes is there were two perspectives to Hobbes. Hobbes actually said that the first law of nature, outside the state of nature, was to seek peace and was to actually do unto others as you wanted to do unto yourself. And one of his arguments was is that my argument as well, is that the war that he's talking about in the state of nature isn't a war, it's actually a war based on fear. So it's a war of self-protection. It's a constant readiness for fighting. And when I read that when I was at Oxford, I thought, hold on a minute, this is the way I've lived my life, this is the way when I'm working with these young people, that these young people are working as well. So these are just some of the musings that I've written down on the train, 5 hours on the train. It's a nice journey. Feel sorry for me, please. We're always drawn to a Hobbesian account of the lives of our young people. In fact, Hobbes is a good place to discern much of what I am discussing. He did suggest that there are two keys to understanding human nature. He even recognised the importance of self-knowledge or honest introspection. As with many contemporary thinkers, Dawkins included, he also believed a general knowledge of science, or in his view, physics, would also assist this. No one is strong enough to ward off all possible... His view was no one is strong enough to ward off all possible attackers. No one is so weak that attacking others would accomplish this if need be. Human beings, Hobbes argues, are not cruel. He quotes that any man should take pleasure in other men's great harms without other ends of his own. I do not conceive it possible. Leviathan 126. But he believed of great importance as a source of war is fear. Thus we come close to the idea of a war in which everyone is fighting everyone else in self-defence. He defines the state of war not as constant fighting, but as a constant readiness to fight, so that no one can relax. Has he overlooked morality? He states that in the state of nature, there is no common power outside the state, so no law. And you've got to understand, that's the way a lot of my young people see it. They're outside the law. So no breach of law, so no injustice. There is a natural right of liberty to do what you want to do to survive. That's the way, when you talk to a lot of my young people, that's the way they will justify it. It's my natural right to protect myself. If I don't, no one else is going to do it for me. Please note, he argues that the first law of nature is to seek peace, is to do unto others what you want to do unto yourself. But he does... Sorry about this. He does say, one of the contradictions in Hobbes is, in the first state of nature, he says that war is a rational response. But in law of nature, he says that peace, and seeking peace, is the first law of nature. Now, one of the things I wanted to bring here, and this is me meshing my mad musings, is 97% of the young people that I work with come to Kids Company seeking peace. They'll go back into the world and they'll fight war and they'll do what they have to do, but they'll come back and have a double existence. This is exactly what I was trying to say about my existence. That, you know, there is no flip. They can be polite to me, they can interact with me, they can do all those things, and they come to us and they look, but as soon as they leave, they're into that mindset. They're into that the first, you know, the state of nature, the right to protect yourself, the idea of natural liberty. And I really want you to understand that, because it's not a paradox for them, it's never been a paradox for me. You know, I still have the capability to do both. That's what I really wanted to share, and that's what these musings are about. It's for us to actually see that sometimes what we posit is this dichotomy, like war and peace, or, you know, black and white, or heavier, and light, aren't the same way that our kids are looking at stuff. Because they are actually living in two worlds, and there is a narrative, and there's a meta-narrative. And one of the things that comes out of Hobbes, which I think people really miss, is that he argues about a collective rationality and an individual rationality. You know, and he actually argued that his collective rationality is what is best for each individual on the assumption that everyone else will act the same way. It's the assumption that everyone will act the same way. My kids don't make that assumption. Their assumption is based on personal experience, that the world is a horrible place that's going to hurt them, it's going to attack them, it's going to do nasty things to them. It's ultimately the prisoner's dilemma. When individual and collective rationality diverge, it's very hard to achieve cooperation and the collectively rational outcomes. So, this is my musing. One way of thinking about Hobbes' argument is that in the state of nature, the individually rational behaviour is to attack others. This will lead to the state of war. However, the laws of nature tell us that the state of war is not an inevitable situation, because another level of behaviour, collective rationality, may also be available. If only we could ascend to the levels of collective rationality and obey the laws of nature, then we could have peace without fear. And ultimately, you know, no, I've never really heard anyone argue this kind of stuff before about Hobbes sort of saying, look, you know, there are some grains of stuff that we can take out of there. Because ultimately, the young people that I work with, and this is me musing, I'm not going to do this, this is all going to be out of my head. The young people that I work with, they are actually looking for something. I don't know what it is. You know, we might call it spirituality, you might call it connection, you might call it grounding, you might call it earthing. But there is something more than them just being biological entities that just consume and produce and just want to. They want to love. They want to connect. They want to express. And all I'm trying to kind of get out of here is I'm wheeled out on so many occasions as a paradigm of change and hope and all those kind of things. And I don't know if I am. I know for me, and I know my individual narrative, I know what worked for me and what didn't work for me. That's all I know. And sometimes the fact I'm standing here and the fact that I've had the life I've had makes no sense to me. I sometimes split between that kind of paradox myself. And one of the problems that I think that we have in this country is we're always trying to understand without actually engaging. We're always trying to presuppose and make these assumptions all the time about what it is to be a young person, what it is to live out on the street. But like I say, we never take on board their assumptions, and their assumptions aren't the exact assumptions that we have, because in their world, it is nasty, brutal and short. We know the figures. There are 1 million young people in the at-risk register, and there's only enough places for 60,000 people. We know all this. We know it's been disputed that, you know, the UN figure on, you know, child well-being, it's been disputed that says that we're now one of the lowest in Western Europe. We have high teenage pregnancy rates. You know, we have all these negative things. But all I wanted to know, and all the question I want to posit, is why are these young people coming to us? Why are these young people searching for things? If it's completely just this dark and, you know, an unwieldy place, why huge amounts? Because on a day-to-day basis, at his company alone, we interfaced with 13,100 young people. You know, I'm in charge of a department, not in charge, I wouldn't say in charge. And yeah, I'm in charge of a department within a department, which is called Positive Experiences. And that's exactly where we're going. We're trying to say, look, let's try and make their lives have much more positive experience, even the things that have had negative. So I'm in charge of education. We have someone who's in charge of work experience. We have someone who's in charge of someone going out and having experiences. And for all those positive experiences that these kids have, and all these interactions they have, they can make their own choices. They can write their own narratives. You know, do you mind if I read you something? Because I was going to take a risk. It's in my pocket. Right. This is not pre-arranged. I was reading it on the way up, and because a lot of the time when I go off and I talk to young people, it's Rumi. Right, yeah.
Hey.
I'm cool. a lot of time when I talk to young people, they always say to me, because they call me Gustav. Gustav, man, why did you study history? And I said, well, because I wanted to create my own story, man. And that is exactly what I'm trying to stay in. It's about giving them the space, allowing them the space to write their own stories, to write their own narratives, not for us to impose our own narratives. It's about mutual cooperation and, you know, and producing it together. So this is my favourite poem that I read to kids. I've been screamed at sometimes for reading it. I've been abused, but a lot of the time, a lot of people come up to me after and say, it actually makes sense. So let's see if this makes sense. So it's called Unfold Your Own Myth. Who gets up early to discover the moment light begins? Who finds us here circling, bewildered like atoms? Who comes to us as spring thirsty and sees the moon reflected in it? Who, like Jacob, blind with grief and age, smells the shirt of his lost son and can see again? Who lets a bucket down and brings up a flowing prophet? Or like Moses, goes for fire and finds what burns inside the sunrise? Jesus slips into a house to escape enemies and opens the door to the other world. Solomon cuts open the fish and there's a gold ring. Omar storms in to kill the prophet and leaves with blessings. Chase a deer and end up everywhere. An oyster opens his mouth to swallow one drop. Now there's a pearl. A vagrant wanders empty ruins. Suddenly he's wealthy. But don't be satisfied with stories. How things have gone with others. Unfold your own myth. Without complicated explanation. So everyone will understand the passage. We have opened you. Start walking towards Shams. Your legs will get heavy and tired. Then comes a moment of feeling. The wind is growing lifted. And that, for me, is kind of the process that I'm trying to get involved in with these young people. It's for them to unfold their own myths. It's for them to create their own structures. It's for them to create their own narratives, their own meta-narratives, their own internal journeys, their own codes. Because ultimately, I believe that we all share the same kind of values, which is we all want to love, we all want to connect, we all want to be witnessed, we all want to feel good about ourselves, and we all want to do that. Because one of the things I have to share with you is, as much as I might say, yeah, I've been called a paedophile, I've been called all these things, and I've been spat at, and I've had things thrown at me, I've had amazing acts of tenderness and kindness and intimacy and things that have changed my life forever and have made me want to stand here and talk about Rumi and talk about the musings of an ex-madman, because it's not about me, it's ultimately about them. And one of the things I live my life by is the path is found in the service of others, not just for prayer beads and holy ropes. And you sometimes see that in the relationships I have with the young people that I work with, that they get something out of the relationship and out of giving. And that's what that's about. It's about us engaging them, as I was saying earlier on the walk, and meeting them where they're at. And that means meeting them in places that we might find uncomfortable, like you said in the poem, legs might buckle, but you know, at some point we'll be lifted up by their inspiration. That's all I wanted to share. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I think there's a roving microphone here which Andrew's going to help me with, but just before, while you gather your thoughts, I think you probably, like me, will have many thoughts. I didn't expect to hear a street worker who went to Oxford to study history, who studied the Renaissance, who became a barrister, who then became a philosopher, and then ended up as a poet. But I think that was
fantastic. Kids can be whatever they want to be.
So can we have an indication, please, of colleagues that want to make comments or questions for Gustav? And if you could say who you are and where you're from, just so you get an idea of what background you're coming from.
Hi,
I really don't mind if you talk, honestly. I'd like you to.
The bus line is always better, isn't it? Just here, please.
My name's Joan, and I work in a secondary school in the east end of Glasgow. And I just found your talk really interesting and moving. And it did make me think of pupils that we might see discussed at our joint support team meetings, where they have very complex needs, yeah. And where you can see that factors in their family situation really affect how they're able to cope with their own lives. And as I think you know, as you said, where they have actually been loved, whatever kind of screw-ups there may have been along the way, their ability to cope and their resilience is higher than those who have, you know, have been cut off from that loving experience. Mm. So I'm not sure where I'm going with this, actually. It's not really a question, it's a bit of a rambling meeting. But I also just wanted to say, I've recently been reading Carol Craig's The Tears That Made the Clyde. And, you know, you may not have seen that, it's just come out fairly recently, it's a very kind of Glasgow book.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, it refers to the spirit level a lot and inequality in society, and I would really agree with what it was saying. And it looks at the history of Glasgow and how the kind of political and economic history of Glasgow has created certain types of families set up or break up or whatever that impacts on youngsters. So as I say, I am just rambling.
I've got some suggestions at the end. I've made some suggestions because for me. I work with predominantly young men, so I think one of the debates I think needs to be addressed is what masculinity means and what manhood means. That's the biggest thing that I address all the time. And there's a type of manhood that's dominant, and it affects all other types of men, and that happens to be based on socioeconomic structure. The same guys that have been ruling for a while, and it affects all working class men, no matter what colour you are, no matter what your religion is, there is a structure that doesn't include you. And that's one of the things I wanted to say. It's not the problems that we face in South East London and Peckham, which are predominantly young Afro-Caribbean males, are the same problems that you face in Leeds and Newcastle and Glasgow. Structures that are there for, have been there for a while.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you so much. This is the second, at least the second great experience I've had this week. I was up in Stirling on, oh sorry, I meant to say who I am.
Sorry.
I think. My name's
Mark. Nice to meet you.
Can
you turn the microphone off, Mark?
Well, I can do it with my mind. thank you. Or Rocky Weir. On and off by itself in the north of Glasgow, and it would be great to have you come and visit sometime. I was at an event in Stirling on Saturday where we had two people of the First Nation, the Cree Nation over from Canada, and they were over here protesting about the Wildback of Scotland's investment in the oil tar sands, and they spoke about how in their language the meaning of the river, the word water, the older people of the village would take the young people out and they could talk about the meaning of the one word water for the time it took for them to walk from the sort of low levels of the stream right up to where the spring for the water was. And I was reminded of their honesty, their truth, and where they were coming from as they recount their experience of their community and how it's been, you know, torn apart by a kind of another value set being put on it. And your truth and your honesty and seeing to the heart of the problems that we're looking at about humanity and about how we value both ourselves and other members of society. I was wondering about your feeling about how now get that paradigm shift, which has always been vital for us to take, but we seem to have been moving, say, in the last two decades further away from that. We seem to be, you know, devaluing people rather than evolving towards a higher understanding. And that's not obviously just in this country, but across the world. So I'm wondering that. Clearly, for me, you're working on that on a human-by-human basis down in London.
Street by street.
Yeah, but I'm interested to see how how we could get a tipping point of that kind of work, how that kind of could come to a kind of social epidemic across the nation.
I think it's happening. I mean, the fact I'm standing here, I'm from London, and then here I've been in Bristol talking to law firms. my wages are paid for by a bank, and I go and talk to the bank exactly how I'm speaking to you. So there are processes out there. It's about looking at the historical moment and realising that there is consumption fatigue. It's whatever you want to say, you want to call it. You know, even the capitalists have to accept that there's consumption fatigue. So there is a void that's waiting to be filled by what we're saying, and I think it's happening much quicker than you realise, because books like Wilkinson, Layard, you've had up here to speak, they're actually having an influence in terms of policy. I read the Demos report on the way up on the train on does character in the family, and even in there they were having to look at proximal and distal influences on people, and they were actually looking at the proximal, the stuff that was in the family, and the kind of internal workings were really, really important. They weren't just structural stuff. So they were actually coming, even in something like that, they were coming closer to the idea that we have to look at relationships and how those relationships influence society and influence people. So it's there. It's out there in all the literature, left or right. It's the acceptance of that there's more to us than just being consumers. So that's my belief, but if anyone else thinks I'm just being optimistic, then I am.
I'm Christopher Humphrey. I work in the health service on equalities and health. Right. My name's Christopher Humphrey. I work in the health service on equalities and health. I think I'm going to pick up something that follows on perhaps quite nicely from what you've just been saying. And one thing that struck me was when you were talking, and I hope I haven't got it wrong, you were talking about teenage girls and that you work with and how what their perception is of having a baby and how that'll shape their lives. And it seemed to be a part to them having a more responsible life and playing a role. And I then went on to think about that, and it was sort of a yes but reaction that a white middle class male working health service might have. Yes but, surely they shouldn't. And again, for males, it seems there's the teenage girls getting pregnant, and then for males we're thinking, or black boys in London, how do we get them to stay at school and do their academic work, or get through exams and get better grades? And it was then thinking, well, are we in a wrong paradigm, perhaps you might use that word, is that a valid path, actually, the path to having a baby? And there's evidence, isn't there, that teenage mums have, you know, can have successful babies, and we've stigmatised that group of mothers. And but thinking about boys then, boys who aren't getting education, aren't getting through exams, and so what life chances do they have? And so what should we be thinking? Should we be thinking that their path to a life on the streets is a valid path if that impinges on other people's lives? And I've nearly finished. I thought of another parallel, very stigmatised community in this country, I suppose, through the whole of UK and indeed through Europe, the Gypsy Traveller community. And I think racism amongst many people is now something that we don't talk about anyway. But racism towards Gypsy Travellers is somehow still allowed. And one reason is perhaps they have a very, very different lifestyle.
Right.
And in my backyard, I don't like to see caravans and whatever going on. So it seems to be a challenge to our way of life.
It has to be. Heterodoxy.
Emma, please.
Hi, my name's Ian McDonald, and I run a youth community development company. And your story was really interesting. I think everyone has an actual story. But looking at the stuff you're doing here, standing up and talking to us, and up and down the country, there's motivational people like you standing up and talking to people who have been invited along to actually listen to them. When you're working with young people directly, I think it's the bit I'm interested in, and can concur with the fact that if a young person who's basically been, excuse the language, shat upon for all of their life, is told once that they're good and they're worthy, the benefit of that to the young person is absolutely phenomenal, mm-hmm. and I think people like Andrew who work with young people will recognise that as you have. I'm getting more interested in how do we get the messages that you're talking about, that other people are actually talking about, into the situations, into the environments that those young people are actually working in. Because it's as much to do with the people who are working with the young people as the other bloody theories and all the stuff that goes on in papers and that. Young people kind of spell strategy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
And there has to be something, I feel, that a kind of grassroots level, if it's in youth work training or if it's in teachers training, that connection back with young people is absolutely crucial. And I don't see that happening.
You don't.
I don't see it. I hear what you're saying about it's happening. It might be happening in rooms. It's not happening with young folk on the street.
One of the reasons, I'll be honest, I like being a frontline worker. I did like being a frontline worker. 3.5 years I've been on the front line, but I've had to move upstairs. I've had to think about, because at the end of the day, we have to work in conjunction with the systems that are there. And so what we're trying to do is, maybe as an organisation, is we've got the macro and micro approach. So the micro approach, if you're running a business, and Camilla would be an amazing business, because in 11 years we've gone from her mortgaging her flat to 11 years later employing 340 people, having a turnover of £11 million, and then replacing with 13,500 children. Right? That's a business, that's a micro thing, so we do what we do there. On a macro level, is we're trying to create the centre of excellence, where we can create these kind of forums, where people can come along, and we can share best practice. And that best practice includes love, includes all that. So it's about actually trying to facilitate the expression of love, and not trying to make people go, oh, love's a strange thing. Politicians need to start using the word love. That's where it starts from. There's no, I did an article recently, and there is no political kind of motivation for politicians to say love. You know, it takes everyone to start using the word love, where love just becomes part of the language, and how we define that and what we do with that. And so, on a macro level, we're creating a centre of excellence. The idea is, at some point, is to have 50 kind of centres like what we do in South East London, in 50 of the major cities, and then we kind of affect change there, and other people with best practices do that. So it's about having ambition as well. It's about us being ambitious and actually saying, we can make a difference, we can. He kept using the word change, and I was saying, I need to make, but anyway, but, do you know what I mean? So, it's there, because it works. They're realising it works. They realise it works. And so in a way, it was really hard, and this is maybe one of the reasons why I'm trying to get people to think, how do you measure anecdotal evidence? How do I measure my life? You know, the only way I've been able to measure my life, and it's one of the things I really wanted to bring you, is I'm the same guy that I was before I went to Oxford. Honestly, I'm the same guy, I think, the exact same way, with the exact same stuff. Exactly the same guy, and all of a sudden, I'm giving this credibility. I'm not talking about here, I've just meant outside externally, that's all I meant. And that's a path that no other kid's going to be able to do. Because mine's an unusual work, and you shouldn't have to go to the extreme just to be recognised. I've had to overachieve to be recognised. And what I'm trying to do is say, look, bypass me, because in spite of me, there's lots. Do you know what I mean? You have to look, and the way I'm looking at it, and this is one of the things I wanted to bring up, is we have to accept there's a different kind of smart. There is a different kind of smartness. You know, and they recognise that in lots of other cultures, and we have this academic culture which is kind of linear and you kind of write and you do stuff. But like I said earlier, in Isaiah Berlin's, you know, Fox and the Hedgehog essay, and, you know, the idea of metis, which the Greeks like, which is perpetual innovation. And, you know, there's a figure I read the other day, 40% of the jobs that are going to be around in the year 2020 didn't exist a while ago. You know, things are changing economically. So I hate using this, but maybe the economic argument is the thing that we've got to start using back as well. Because we don't have the right workforce, because critical thinking, you know, self-regulation, we're going to be living in a post-climatic change environment. So all these things, you know, some of the skills that the young people that I work with have in terms of innovation, in terms of, you know, you know, be able to, you know, apply themselves to different situations and survive, the skills that we're going to need as a society anyway. And that's what we have to accept. Society's changing, way beyond recognition. We were talking on the way earlier that the whole idea of, you know, in my lifetime, I'm 43, and I didn't know mobile phones. The idea of intimacy. You know, I read some research in Wilkinson that said, you know, the average person can only deal with 150 people. You know, on my Facebook, I've got 500 friends on Facebook. That freaks me out. I don't know. You know, it's there. We just have to find a way of shaping the wind to come out with. Sorry.
I've only got 10 friends on Facebook, so I've got there seems to be a theme emerging from the last lecture I went to. It was a guy called Mark Smith who works in residential care. He's now a professor. He challenges us to think about the idea of loving young people. And if you've ever worked in residential care, the idea that you would form personal relationships with young people and show them affection and intimacy.
Do you mind if I interrupt there? Because we encourage a touching policy in some areas. You know, it's done within, but we're told if they need to be touched, they need to be hugged. That's really... So just on that level, you know.
And for me, that as a manager of NHS Children's Services, there's major complications there.
The
question that you raised earlier about how do we take this further? For me to embed that sort of thinking in the training of staff and their day-to-day practice is hugely culturally difficult. Mm-hmm. The next lecture, is which I'll trail in the end, is about power and love. And again, the theme of love comes through. The idea that you have to, if you want to connect back to the natural world and the things that makes us all human beings, then we have to deprofessionalise the relationships that we have with young people. Landon de Castellas here, we might want to put it in the spot just now, talk about the parenting framework for Glasgow and the idea that we think that we can support parents to understand the relationships that they develop with their children and the power of those relationships to transform their children's lives. So there seems to be a recurring theme in these three lectures, which I think has major significant implications for the public sector. And in Glasgow, the public sector is a major employer. You know, it employs many staff, and many of us are parents, and many of us are young people. So I think it's worth asking you to comment on that, Gustav. But it's also worth throwing that back to the audience, who might think about that from their own perspective and make some comment on it.
Hi, I'm Louise McDonald. I'm Chief Executive at Young Scotland, an information agency for young people across Scotland. I don't really know where to start because there's just so many kind of things I want to kind of pick up on.
It's amazing,
and incredibly moving as well, I think, in terms of that. So it's fabulous. And I think a couple of kind of things, just going to say one, just okay, I think we probably stressed the love point, but I'm just so delighted that we started using that word, you know, stop being afraid of it and so on, and I think that's amazing. What I think is really impressive, though, is the fact that you guys are going back to Maslow and actually kind of using that as a base and as a fundamental, because I think actually the kind of bigger narrative around that is how people are coming back to that in the wake of the economic crash, and actually how people are starting to reconnect with that, but also how that's coming through in terms of the kind of the response to climate change. And actually, if you look at some of the kind of eco-psychology work and the work that's going on around our place in nature and our place in the world, it's kind of Maslow as well. I'm really interested in terms of young people's connection with nature in all of this, because in terms of gangs and environment and nations, actually their kind of relationship with the wilderness or nature.
It's an urban environment. I mean, one of the things I wanted to bring is that, you know, last year for the first time ever, 50% of the world's population lived in cities. Now we're still dealing with that. That the urban landscape is a landscape. We still try and impose this kind of like Garden of Eden idea of what aesthetic value is and what beauty is. But some of these guys find beauty in a concrete stairwell on the street corner, and you have to accept that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we're like, why are they dying over that? But it's, why do we die over the green and pleasant fields?
And the last thing I just want to kind of raise as well is, I think your kind of point about wings in the poem, I think, is a really powerful one. I was at a lecture with some former Oxford colleagues who were entrepreneurs, and talking about, my philosophy is, you know, you jump off the bridge and you build your wings on the way down, and there'll be someone there to pick you up at the bottom if it all goes wrong. That was the day after two girls jumped off the Erskine Bridge Niamh in Georgia, and they were like 14 and 15. They'd been in care for a long time. There were lots and lots of people who could have helped and were meant to help them, but we still have children jumping off bridges, and that's not a world.
That's a world, absolutely.
And lastly, why do we all forget what it was like to be children?
Oh, no.
There's no there wasn't one. Yeah. What's that about? Why do we forget who we were and what it felt like growing up? So that antipathy really
there's interesting. An interesting statistic I read on the way up on the train that 50% of parents now won't let their 11-year-olds go out, but when they were 11, they went out. So we've changed the idea of outside and space. And one of the things I really wanted to bring the code of the street is basically Now, there's pedagogy on the streets, much as anything else. You know, there's an oral tradition in lots of cultures that is placed on the street. The street's where you patrol yourself, it's where you learn about yourself. And this idea of, in a way, that these guys have to reclaim the street for themselves. And there was a convention in 2001 that the UN did in Beijing, and it sort of said that streets are the place where young people should congregate and should learn as public space. And I think that's another debate we have to have about how we design cities and who is a city for. Because, you know, I read a lot of David Harvey when I was at Oxford, you know, the Marxist geographer, and he sort of said, control of space is what, you know, inculcated Germany and all those kind of things. And I think that the way we patrol the streets as much as it is, and the way we let kids patrol streets, they're not even involved in the design of the streets, they're going to live on for the next 50 years after we're gone. So it's a bit, you know, we have to start involving them in the whole process of creation. So for me, it's about co-creation.
Anyone, please?
Hi there. My name's Heather, and I run a small organisation where groups of people, we help with teenagers basically to act as advisors and consultants to big organisations. And I just wanted to pick up this issue about how adults who are involved in supporting these kind of initiatives need to perhaps be a bit more thoughtful about their own kind of mindsets and their own behaviours. And what I really wanted to say was, first of all, one of the big reasons why I do what I do is because I heard a young man speak a number of years ago about his own narrative, his own life story, and he said that it's the job of a teacher to help a young person discover who they are and not to tell them who they ought to be. And the thing that I've learned now in my 10 years of trying to respond to that is how hard it is to do that and how much courage you need. And so what we're now starting to do is to work, in our projects, the young people basically are very happy to occupy the space that you talked about. Mm. The adults are the ones who actually conspire to keep them out of the space. And so our work now, a lot, is about how to help adults understand their own assumptions and their own attitudes to fear and risk and their own behaviours, and to really start to explore their own personalities and their own acts, and then to allow that space to be created for young people. And it's a really interesting place for us to be right now, because like you guys are saying, I think times are changing, and we're finding people are now really interested to come and talk to us about what we've learned about that work and how we can kind of build on it.
I hate saying it's cost effective. Mm-hmm. I don't want to bring it up, but it is cost effective. We've done a lot of the measurements about, because the recidivism rates of young people that we work with, 82% don't reoffend within a year of being with us, and the truancy rates are the same. You know, it works. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, the kids regulate themselves. Mm-hmm. It's about we were talking earlier, it's about actually kind of holding them where they need to be held, when they tell you where they need to be held. You know, just holding them there and be able to sit in their emotions and learn their resilience. Yeah. And there's a quote that I keep using, hope and change, anyway, whatever. But the mirror of hope is resilience. So you have to give these guys this kind of narrative, this let them dream a little bit, let them fly a bit, because with that, when you get knocked down in your life, it's your internal mechanisms of hope and dreams that allow you to get back up again. So if you don't give them that, you're just giving them structural stuff. It's not just going to be enough. You start feeling an addict, and they are addicted to certain things, because that's the only way they're going to have. So right, there is cognitive research that actually backs up a lot of what we're saying. I think that you secrete enough adrenaline, you know, over a certain amount of time, it puts on that, and violence suddenly becomes something. So there's lots of research around that. So I don't really want to get into the cognitive behavioural stuff, because we're doing lots of research with Great Ormond Street, and that backs up what we're saying, that literally, if you did a brain scan in some of the kids before we introduced touch and love, there's dark spots, parts of their brain, and then when you do it again, the light comes on. It's a bit simplistic, but, you know, I don't just want to make it like the Dawkins way, it's just been a biological reason why we do it. It's because we like it as well. And there has to be like and joy and emotion and love and all those things. It has to be fun. I think sometimes when we talk to young people, we say, your life is crap, and we're going to talk about it and make it even crappier. And it's like, well, am I going to listen to you? You guys, you know, you have to say, look, man, your life's amazing. The potential in your life is amazing. Can't you see it? It's got to be fun. It's got to be joy. I think we've over-professionalised to a point we've taken out the joy of why we do what we do. Because I love working with young people. As much as it's hard, there's nothing more, I keep saying, it's really cliche, but, you know, there's nothing more enjoyable than watching a young person's light come on. You know, you see it, and that keeps you going for a long, long time.
We're running it.
Sorry.
So, any last comments? Any questions?
Thanks for talking to us as well.
Thank you. As I I said earlier, we've got some anarchies, please speak for that.
Could I say something as well? I just wanted to say thank you for listening to me, because this is the first time I've ever done anything like this. I actually sincerely mean that. And it's nice to know that, you know, it seems a bit cliche, but it's nice to know that our brothers and sisters come.
Please stay, and I'm sure your staff will want to stay and talk. And last thing I need to do is, I trailed it earlier, but the next seminar series is on the 18th of May. It's the third lecture, and it's a man called Adam Cahane, who apparently wrote the Montfleur scenarios for Nelson Mandela, so he's a good pedigree. But he wants to come and talk to us about power and love, and I think his main proposition is that our current behaviour, where we juxtapose aggression and conflict with negotiation and compromise, is flawed. And I think Gustavus trailed some of the ideas where the combination of power and love is actually the solution to that conflict. So please attend if you can. The venue is to be confirmed, but the information will be in the Glasgow Centre for Population Health website. So please stay. Thank you very much.